I'd like to welcome you all to our talk today. We've got Dr. Cowan, who was willing to give us his afternoon to talk about the fact that writing itself can be a means of discovery. And so for those of you who often begin your essays and you're stuck, you don't know where to begin, I think that today's talk will actually be very helpful to you as you learn that just writing itself might actually teach you where to begin. So please welcome Dr. Cowan.
Thank you. It's great to see you. For some of my students who are sprinkled in the audience, these next lines are going to be all too familiar. I was looking for a literary source for writing, you know, a great scene of writing. And Matt, if you can think of any others, or any of you can think of any others, I'd be glad to know about it. But here's the one I thought of. One of the most famous scenes of writing in American literature begins with Arthur Dimmesdale returning to his lodging to write his sermon for Election Day in Puritan Boston, a sermon that will prove to be the final one of his life. There on the table, he says, writes Hawthorne, with the inky pen beside it, was an unfinished sermon with a sentence broken in the midst, where his thoughts had ceased to gush out upon the page 2 days before. He knew that it was himself, the thin and white-cheeked minister, who had done and suffered these things and written thus far into the election sermon. But he seemed now to stand apart and eye this former self with scornful, pitying, but half-envious curiosity. That self was gone. Another man had returned out of the forest, a wiser one, with a knowledge of hidden mysteries, with the simplicity, which the simplicity of the former never could have reached, a bitter kind of knowledge that. Now, you may not have the Scarlet Letter fresh in your mind, but what's happening here near the end of the novel is that after years apart, he has finally reunited with Hester Prynne, and they've declared their love for each other against all the laws of the colony, and he has decided in a desperate move to go back to Europe with her. He comes back. He is the one who is destined to write this great sermon for the greatest holiday of the year for the Boston colony, and he sees it halfway written, and he knows that he can't continue it. So he's looked upon it, and in the Hawthorne somewhat overwrought language, it says his writing had ceased to gush out upon the page. Now, I know you've all had that experience when your writing has ceased to gush out upon the page. That's what we're talking about today. Why Arthur Dimmesdale had stopped writing, we know. He could no longer continue keeping up a pretense of what he did not truly feel or think. He thinks all of his ministry during those years had been a pretense, had been a lie, because he could never confess to his love affair with Hester Prynne. None of what he has written rang true anymore. Now, as he returns to that room in which everything looks the same, his entire world has changed. Well, from a biological perspective, Dimmesdale is nearing a premature death from self-torture, as out of guilt. As a writer, he is encountering an ideal situation. Stunning reversals have slammed him. Rediscovering his love for Hester after all these years and confessing it to her, finding out that Chillingworth has been manipulatively torturing him for years, facing and giving voice to the hopelessness of his situation. Your best moments for writing may come when you've given up all the false hopes that have been supporting you in your writing. And then still clinging to that last false hope of a mad escape with his lover, he is blindsided by his own mind as suddenly and repeatedly on his walk back home, he encounters parishioners of his and is swarmed with inner thoughts of the power of corruption and seduction that he holds over them. What is he to make of himself and his world. Has Dimmesdale formulated how his world has changed? What that new and bitter knowledge is that Hawthorne writes about? I think rather that he was in the utmost turmoil after encountering his fellow Bostonians on that walk back from the forest and knew not at all what to make of it. Yet, he seems to have reached a state of inner resolution as he greets Chillingworth with a dismissive mastery he has never been capable of before. He then acts decisively, and here is how Hawthorne presents this scene. Left alone, the minister summoned a servant of the house and requested food, which being set before him, he ate with ravenous appetite. Then, flinging the already written pages of the election sermon into the fire, he forthwith began another, which he wrote with such an impulsive flow of thought and emotion that he fancied himself inspired, and only wondered that heaven should see fit to transmit the grand and solemn music of its oracles through so foul an organ pipe as he. However, leaving that mystery to solve itself or go unsolved forever, he drove his task onward with earnest haste and ecstasy. Thus the night fled away as if it were a winged steed, and he careering on it. Morning came and peeped blushing through the curtains, and at last sunrise threw a golden beam into the study and laid it right across the minister's bedazzled eyes. There he was, with the pen still between his fingers and a vast, immeasurable tract of written space behind him. Last words of chapter 20, one of the last chapters of The Scarlet Letter. What a great composition scene. Wow, how can writing be that dramatic, we ask. And yet, for you, it can. If you're on the holding side of the pen. Now, other than that teasing figure of the winged steed, Pegasus, right, being the traditional and especially the romantic symbol of poetic inspiration, Hawthorne draws a veil over the minister's actual process of thinking and writing. But clearly he was in a state not only of hopelessness, as I've said, but also of resolution, as his flinging his old draft into the fire shows, a state of desire to write, as expressed by the fire that seems to be stoking him as the old draft burns, and ravenous, as it says, not just to eat, but to know himself. For as he sits down to write, he has reached no new knowledge yet. His will has gathered together into a state of potency, but his mind has not yet determined the nature of the new state of things he has intuited. That winged steed is a small clue that Hawthorne is drawing on his own experience of the process of inspiration and composition. But his use of his own novelist's workshop of creative writing as a model for the making of a sermon, a prose nonfiction essay, tells us that he's drawing on what is essentially shared by both artistic and non-artistic oratorical composition. So we can learn from Nathaniel Hawthorne, but what we learn, I think, is simply good sense. It is no esoteric doctrine, and it is, I think, once I lay it out, easy to understand. Dimmesdale must discover what his new comprehension of the world entails, and he writes with the savage vigor of one making a long-withheld confession, for that is exactly what he is doing. Writing is a process of discovering meaning. That is the point for your writing that I wish to draw from this famous scene. Rather than being the development of some preconceived and well-formed idea, writing is the record of an idea developing. It is the process whereby an initial idea gets extended and refined. We shape utterances as we write, but careless of whether they are correctly formed. Our only care at this stage is that they record our thought at the moment. Seeing our ideas on paper enables us to reflect upon them and develop them further, propelling our thoughts dynamically in a direction we did not know they wanted to go. Writers at this stage are like miners excavating a seam of precious metal. And when the seam is played out, or they get interrupted. They get started again by reading what they have written and responding to it afresh. Now, if we give ourselves honestly to this process, then eventually, as Dimmesdale's example suggests, we end up with a product that teaches us something, that clarifies what we know or what we have known only implicitly, and that lifts out or explicates or enlarges our experience. With any luck and with repeated application, you'll come to feel joy in the act of writing, because writing is the making of meaning. Just now, I referred to writing as a dynamical process in which your mind is reacting to what you've just written and produces a response. We are, as a famous critic has said, dialogical beings. We seem to naturally produce dialogue, even when there's no one there to dialogue with. Sometimes that's the best way to produce dialogue. One comment naturally leads to another. But I don't want to give the impression that we're chained to what we've written, that we're iron-bound to respond to everything that we've said. Dead ends are frequent experiences and are no-fault occurrences. Writing, as discovery, is a repeated process of beginning over again, starting over anew. We have to be rash enough to leave out a chunk of writing while we move on to writing about something else that stimulates us. Eventually we'll come back, collect them all, and then worry about tying them together. That's a different process. The thing that I'm recommending to you is to follow that spirit of inquiry that is like a passion, that, as we saw with Dimmesdale, heats one up, to follow it. So the process I'm recommending to you involves a letting go, setting aside all your bullet points, and just writing. Not about whatever comes into your head, so not what compositionist jargon calls free writing, but free enough. As you nail your shoes to the topic about which you must write, and then make yourself as free as possible to respond in every other way. All right, so now I want to make an additional point about writing as discovery. UD students should especially warm to this notion of writing as discovery, since our university is committed to being a center of learning in which new thought springs from the soil of the great tradition, with students themselves taking part in that vital process of discovery. The UD curriculum stresses that there is something real to discover, that there is such a thing as truth, even though it is off there gleaming in the distance. How precious that very simple recognition is. I am here to tell you, after having taught for years at a public university where any reference to truth grew increasingly scarce as the years went on. Truth is hard to know and articulate and will almost always elude final and complete expression. It is not a given, but must be discovered time and time again, each time in a new way. Writing is the means of discovering one's unique path to truth, a journey that creates meaning all along the way. So make no mistake, writing is the making of meaning. It is not the recording of a pre-existing meaning, but rather its creation. The act of setting one's thoughts down on paper to give them their full scope is in itself an act of learning. In developing an idea, discovering its origins and consequences, the writer finds that he has encountered an entire fabric of significance, which is not simply his own invention, but leads him on to greater discoveries. It is in this discovery that he realizes the full extent of learning and becomes aware of the power of thought to alter lives and circumstances. Herman Melville, while in the process of composing Moby Dick, wrote in a letter to a friend, "It will be a strange sort of book, I fear. Blubber is blubber, you know, though you may get oil out of it. The poetry runs as hard as sap from a frozen maple tree." Yet I mean to give the truth of the thing, spite of this. The truth of the thing is all one need aim at, and it is enough. Without this commitment to truth, and that's the veritatem in UD's seal, composition becomes simply a way of manipulating tired material into something conventional, or alternatively, into something temporarily new and entertaining. With truth as a goal, however much blubber it requires you to boil, good writing comes first of all out of a commitment to use composition as a means to deeper understanding. The billions of different perspectives that people bring to the reality that they perceive in the world tells of the need to know things from many perspectives other than one's own. To say this is not relativism. There is no one encoded truth, and for that reason, truth is not static. The admission of many perspectives, including one's own, is an act of species-wide intellectual humility. No man is God. No human being can know the thing as God knows it. And marvelously, this does not mean that we should give up trying to know. The vital need of the world for your perspective on reality cannot be erased, and this is a wonderfully empowering thought. At the same time, it's a break on your ego. For no matter how totally you nail that insight of yours, it remains a full expression of insight from your perspective. It can never be the final word. So here we are, stuck in the middle. Let's get our pens and pencils going. The quest is for insight, not simply for self-expression or simply for correct expression. What this means is that the writer must conceive of the operation as consisting of two separate parts. First, using writing as a means of discovery, which implies writing without editing, as one goes. And then, the second movement, in which one applies all the effective principles of composition and rhetoric to the thought one has discovered. And yes, grammar and spelling. Effective communication is one of the goals of writing. And teachers will famously hammer you for being unclear. But effective communication is not the chief thing that college writing or writing in general is about. Having to come to terms with writing an essay on a work of art, such as you frequently have to do here, provides a discipline that stems not from external paraphernalia, such as outlining, adhering to an assigned length, or citing a prescribed number of examples, but from following wherever the inner logic of thought impels. Premature and rigid attempts to correct and edit your work will truncate the flow of composing. When attention to form becomes the dominant and absorbing activity, the act of writing as discovery cannot be explored. The strategies to resort to when seeking to make this honest writing come out may seem perverse. My spouse, Christine, herself possessed of a BA magna cum laude and an MA from UD, relates a moment from her student days when she received a C+ on her paper from her most challenging teacher, who happened to be my mother. The comment said, "Don't prepare so much. You need to write your paper the night before it's due." Now, I wouldn't want to give this advice to every student all the time. But the point, as Chris found out, was to force the student to relinquish her own elaborate thinking with its incorporation of much learning and to rely rather on her inner resources as well as on the larger structure of meaning contained in the literature and in language itself. Reluctantly giving up any ideas of thinking out your papers entirely before you begin, you learn to fill your imagination with the work at hand and so discover the necessary freedom for original thought. Along with this discovery will come the realization of the importance of bold declaration of major premises, of seeing the inherent paradoxes in your assumptions, and of developing and extending your insights. Bold declaration of major premises, inherent paradoxes in your own assumptions, explore them, and developing and extending your insights. And in longer papers, the process of revision, too, becomes an act of creation once writers have understood the main thrust of their thought and its necessary relationships. Revision becomes a process not just of correcting your earlier writing, but of rethinking it and thinking it further. So it should be clear that when I say discovery, I do not mean only what is often meant by the word in rhetoric and composition studies, discovery of a topic that you can write about. That means nothing more than being resourceful. By discovery, however, what I mean is discovery of what you really think, but didn't know that you did. Too many students approach writing with the attitude that they already know all they need to know and that they just need to prove their brilliance to an audience. And in reality, you're all still students, and writing is that process of really coming to know what you are learning. Alternatively, you may feel yourself so ill-equipped that how can you dare approach a paper? Again, you know, face the text, just you and it, with your honest self, and explore what you truly mean. Now in 1835, the brilliant Alexis de Tocqueville was already cautioning lovers of democracy that the tendency of those who live in a democratic society is to demand more and more ready-made, easily unpackable experiences. We are impatient with process in America. We want instant answers, instant products. But process is what learning is. To be in that slow moment in which you ask yourself, what do I mean? What do I mean? And repeat again, what do I mean? I'm discouraged when I look around at the wisdom of some of my brethren in composition studies, not here, but around the nation. The University of North Carolina College of Arts and Sciences Writing Center has produced guidelines easily available. I'm not going to tell you anything about them because they're frightfully inadequate and make one worry that new ways of writing without thinking are being devised all the time and will ultimately dominate the field of college composition in America if they have not done so already. What if we truly believe there is no truth, that there are only expressions? Let's just say I differ with Nietzsche on this, or at least I think I do. I don't see that as a liberating thing. I think instead it enables our mental sloth. And the University of North Carolina has elaborated all kinds of games a writer can play in order to churn out paragraphs on any subject. I've got to say, this reminds me a little of the South Park episode, and you know which one I'm going to say, in which the writers for Family Guy were finally found out to be manatees bouncing around balls with things written on them. Maybe you didn't see that episode. Okay. I just thought the manatees was a funny touch. But, all right, after slamming my colleagues, I'm going to recover and say, but not all professional collegiate approaches to writing have it wrong, and not by a long shot. No less than the National Council of Teachers of English has a statement on writing that gets it about as right as it is possible to get. And I was very cheered up to see this because it's a rare moment in which true wisdom is aligned with the conventional wisdom. True wisdom, of course, being mine. So the NCTE, you can look for this yourself online, NCTE, or National Council of Teachers of English, says, when writers actually write, they think of things that they did not have in mind before they began writing. The act of writing generates ideas. This is different from the way we often think of writers, as getting ideas fixed in their heads before they write them down. The notion that writing is a medium for thought is important in several ways. It suggests a number of important uses for writing: to solve problems, to identify issues, to construct questions, to reconsider something one had already figured out, to try out a half-baked idea. This insight that writing is a tool for thinking helps us to understand the process of drafting and revision as one of exploration and discovery, and is nothing like transcribing from pre-recorded tape. The writing process is not one of simply fixing up the mistakes in an early draft, but of finding more and more wrinkles and implications in what one is talking about. Thus, my colleagues in the National Council of Teachers of English. All right. Now, we can also look at writing this way. Some of the work we do at writing is for others, and some of it is for us. It simply makes sense that there has to be a stage of writing that completely disregards correctness because it records an inner dialogue wherein the writer is attempting to clarify and specify the ideas about which he has a hunch. In this way, writing generates thought. But it cannot do it if we're focused on communicating adequately with others. All that is indisputably necessary, but it comes after one has reached some satisfaction in finding out what one wants to say and articulating it. The interesting thing is that this process of finding out what we mean, what we want to say, does not just issue in some golden nugget that you can put on display in your first paragraph or something while you throw away all the dross that remains from the making of the nugget. What you actually find is that much of what you have written, in order to get to your clearest idea, is worth retaining because it retains that process of discovery and distinction that is often helpful for readers as well, because it leads them through the same process of discovery and distinction that you went through. So your writing, you not only get more words that way, but it becomes a more dynamic process of discovery. Now, back to that winged steed. There's a creative center in each one of us, not simply those who consider themselves gifted or capable in poetry writing. And this is not about poetry writing, but about writing. This is that sense that is like a sense of shape that does not manifest itself directly to you in words, but in a sense of something. It is operative in those blessed moments in which you've been working hard at writing something and have come up against 30 minutes straight of banging your head against the keyboard, so you decide to go to sleep or go kick the ball around or take a shower, and not long after you start at one of those things, an idea pops into your head that you couldn't have guessed before, but that is exactly the fresh point of view from which you've been needing to see your subject. Has that ever happened to you? It's happened to me frequently. What is that sense? Is it creative intuition? One of our great Catholic philosophers, Jacques Maritain, calls it creative intuition. I'm never sure I know what intuition is, so I think it can be described as an activity of imagination. But we mustn't think of imagination as voluntary always. This is involuntary. It happens to you because you've been caring about something and then turned away from it, focused on something else, and those active parts of your mind have gone to rest. And suddenly that other side of your mind can come bring out that link that you've been waiting for and have not found. Imagination is not always, and most profoundly is not at all, a clever thinking up of some new figure or story. It is instead a different way of seeing or understanding the things that are there in front of you, seeing them in a different light or in a different configuration. So all of that is a part of letting go that takes place in the process of composition. Now, if it takes a flash of insight to make that leap of connection as possible in real learning, and for the stimulus to make this come about, we must set aside what we already know, make the work of art, confront our minds directly, and have our pencils at the ready. Now you might want to ask, okay, all this is very nice and very high-minded rhetoric, but what do I get to take home from this? So I followed some possible questions to ask yourself that will help stimulate this process. Once you know that process is what you're looking for, these are not modules that you just snap into place and they do all the work for you. These are modules that make you do the work. What do I really think? These are simple questions. What does this mean? Once again, rinse and repeat, as they say. What difference does this make? What concepts does this action take part in? What ideas does this idea relate to? simple things like that that keep you running, keep you on the move, but also try to take you deeper into what meaning is. As you seek to integrate your learning at UD, there are some other kinds of questions that you can ask when writing about literature. How does this relate to things like the three parts of the soul in the ancient Greek tradition, right? The rational, the passionate, and the appetitive. How does this relate to those various spheres of order in which human beings all participate? The family, the city, nature, the past and present of the human race, history that is, the cosmos, the divine-human relation. Shift gears and look at it from a different perspective. Right? How does this relate to the virtuous life? To the virtues themselves? Alternatively, ask not how it relates to ideas, but how it relates to real life as you think you know it. You yourself, because yes, you've lived a little bit. Perhaps a lot, I don't know. But you have. How does that relate to your own experience? Consult your own experience and your sense of what is right and wrong, and your sense of sympathy, your sense of what human beings are like, of human nature. And afterward, you apply the principles of rhetoric. So, I think I've been pretty repetitive on this notion, but here's my summary. Since UD is a unique university that focuses on truth, good writing comes first of all out of a commitment to use composition as a means to deeper understanding. What this means is that the writer must conceive of the operation as consisting of two separate parts, first using writing as a means of discovery, which implies writing without editing as one goes. And then a second movement in which one applies all the effective principles of composition and rhetoric to the thought that one has discovered. What inhibits writing a good deal of the time is editing as one goes. Anything profound will never be discovered in that way, so my approach to composition is to use writing as a means of discovery. Thank you. Questions? Well, I do have a response to that, and I think outlines are certainly an important part of a process, especially the longer the work that you have to write, the more an outline is imperative. But it's almost never the case that you begin with an outline, because that indicates that your scheme of thought is not your own and is not genuine. Right? It's somebody else's, or it's what you used to think. Right? So I think you have to do some thinking on paper before you come up with that first outline. But I don't think you should say, you know, never, no outlines, right, and so forth.
Well, I wasn't, by the way, and I'm all one of those people who feels very strongly you never start with pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Because then, you know, it's like you end up with pieces. Like Shakespeare was a great writer.
Right.
Great. But I think sometimes there are structural things. I had a student who was not sure what to do with Lord Jim. She was just overwhelmed by it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, well, you know, just try, do a picture. Like a diagram, picture of the narrative voice. And just look what's happening.
Uh-huh.
Just go through and get a sense of the order, the structure of the material.
Yes.
And that's not a structure voice in saying that. It's just a matter of getting command over the form, even if you would like.
Mm-hmm. I think you're quite right, yeah. Now, sometimes we fuss at students for retelling the story, but if you're dealing with a poem by Mallarmé or, you know, some impossibly difficult poem, the teacher may end up saying, why didn't you try to tell the story of this poem? Because that's the only way you can start to get a grip on it. So all that is you know, if telling the story is a way of getting the meaning, you know, then it can be very helpful. You all have any questions? Did I give you anything to take away on that? Got a particular problem with a particular paper? Why not throw it out here?
Thank you very much.